Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 139, Conscious Living and Dying, February 22nd, 2008. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
I think that death strips away everything that is unimportant and gives us the chance to be our most authentic selves. So if we fully engage, there's no place to run away and hide. And I think that brings out the potential in each person to actually see what the cycle of life is really about. And in some ways, I would describe it as the miracle of death. The miracle of life and the miracle of death are interwoven.
That was the voice of my guest, Anna Maria Hemingway. Anna Maria Hemingway, M-A-A-B-D, is the author of the 2008 book, Practicing Conscious Living and Dying, and also writes articles for various magazines on this topic. She's a member of the International Association for Near-Death Studies and a spiritual counselor. Anna Maria has an MA in consciousness psychology and also in mythology and depth psychology, and is currently completing her doctoral dissertation on the topic of the near-death experience, a mythic model for conscious living and dying. She's also worked in hospice. Now, here's the interview. Anna Maria Hemingway, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hi, David. Thank you for having me on the show.
Yes, well, I'm glad to have you here. And let me say at the outset that I think you've written a very fine book. And I have to admit, I initially approached it as something of a skeptic, in as much as I'm still pretty much on the fence when it comes to life after death. But skeptic or not, I found the personal accounts you've collected to be inspiring.
Well, I'm pleased to hear that, because that was really what I wanted to do with the book. There is no concrete evidence either way, and who knows whether there ever will be, but there are certainly the experiences that we all have every day that seem to point that this could be a fact, that life after death may well continue.
Well, I'd love to have my listeners get a feeling for what you've done here and for your writing. So let's start out by having you read a passage from your book. There's a beautiful section of commentary that you've written about a quarter of the way in. I think it begins on page 65.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. Less than 100 years ago, it was impossible to escape or deny the reality of death. For epidemics of childhood diseases and limited medical knowledge resulted in death and dying as being a part of everyday life. In contemporary Western cultures, advancements in healthcare and a longer lifespan have resulted in society adopting the concept of ignoring death, the dying, and the bereaved, in order to somehow forget that death is an integral part of life. This approach leads to fear and alienation from the ultimate reality of existence, and leaves us traumatized and feeling alone when the inescapability of death touches our lives. However, a deeper understanding of the enormity and inevitability of death, which may claim those of any age or circumstance, can result in a positively transformative, life-affirming experience.
Yes, thank you. And of course, people are going to pick up that you have some sort of an accent there. You probably can't hear it, but I can. Tell us a little bit about where you're from and where you are now.
I actually come from England, the south coast of England. I'm sure that's the accent. In a coastal town called Brighton on the south coast. about 60 miles from London, mm-hmm. and I'm currently in California, actually doing the final part of a PhD course and writing my dissertation on the subject of the near-death experience, a mythic model for conscious living and dying. So that's why I'm here at the moment.
Well, that's great. And I've never been to Brighton. I've been to London, and Brighton has certainly played a role in lots of the novels that I've read over the years. So the next time I get over there, I'm going to have to check out Brighton.
You should.
Yes.
It's beautiful in the sunshine.
Okay.
If you're lucky enough.
Yeah, right, when there is sunshine, right? So let me ask you to describe the structure of the book for our audience, because it has kind of a special structure.
Well, the structure of the book is looking at different interactions with death and dying. The first section is a history, if you will, or description of the near-death experience. Many people think that this is a fairly a phenomenon that only actually takes place nowadays because we hear about it in the newspapers and people are more ready to talk about it. But actually, it has a long history. So I discuss that a little bit, and then I follow up with five people who have had a near-death experience, who describe their own experiences and the changes that have taken place in their lives. The second part is actually dealing with people who have had some interaction with death and the dying process, either losing somebody or else actually accompanying somebody on this very sacred journey of transition that takes place. And again, how this has resulted in a very inspirational, transformative experience for them. And the last section of the book really looks at the whole idea, as far as we can, of does consciousness exist after death of the physical body? And in this section, I have taken as much information from many diverse cultures. I wasn't wanting to write a scholarly book, but I was wanting to bring in as much evidence as possible. And this, again, is then followed up by stories of people who have experienced some of the things I have talked about previously in the text. So what I've tried to do is to bring these facts or bits of information to people's attention and then show and illustrate that actually real life people like you or me have actually had this type of experience and maybe pondering on that a little bit and seeing how widespread it can be, that everybody seems to have had something happen to them which is out of everyday reality that they cannot explain fully, seems to point to the fact that there is something else going on.
Well, I can acknowledge that part, certainly. While I haven't had any intimations of life after death, I certainly have had intimations that there's more going on here than meets the eye. And I wanted to pick up on a couple of words that you use. You mentioned inspirational and transformative. And I was reading this book before going to sleep each night, and, you know, part of me was in resistance to doing that. Do I really want to read about death before I go to sleep at night? Is this going to be, you know, kind of a heavy topic? There's mm-hmm. a natural resistance to wanting to even go anywhere near this topic. I can even imagine that some listeners might choose to skip this show because, oh, death, do I want to listen to people talking about death? But yet, as I read, and really your book is a wonderful collection of vignettes woven together by the kinds of theoretical connections that you were just speaking of. And I did find the vignettes that you shared, as well as your own writing, to be both inspirational and transformative and really good material to read before going to bed at night. Now, I noticed that every chapter begins with a quote from Plato, and mm-hmm. I guess I don't know Plato that well. Why Plato? Is he important in the history of conscious living and dying?
I think he is, because at the end of the Republic, Plato actually uses a near-death experience, which he retells in the Myth of Ur, that describes how a soldier on the battlefield was killed, and then when taken for burial a few days later, he came back to life. And he then described what had happened to him, and how he had been on this journey, and it's very much written in the time of Plato, but it carries all the same components that people who have a near-death experience in contemporary times have. So I thought it was a very interesting place to start from, and I liked Plato would be one of the people I'd like to meet and have a conversation with when one's asked who would you most like to speak to. And I felt that he was actually speaking to me in some way. And so it was interesting for me that I found a quote from Plato that exactly matched each story. So it worked very well.
Interesting. Now, as I say, the book does consist of a series of vignettes, and I haven't prepped you for this, but I'm wondering if there's any one of these accounts that stands out for you that you could describe here.
Well, it's a hard thing to do because I think all of the stories carry such a powerful message. In a sense, I'm interested in the stories where a person perhaps doesn't have any belief in an afterlife, but through engaging with a dying person, where something shifts in consciousness, I believe, through my interactions with people on this sacred journey. So I feel that Joanne's story in particular, someone who was so totally transformed by the stillbirth of her daughter and went on to do such remarkable things, is a very good example of what I'm trying to get at here in the book. How
I'm glad you chose that one, because if you had come up with a blank, that would have been the one that I would have chosen. So do go ahead and give us the sense of Joanne's story.
Well, Joanne was a young mother, you know, with a normal young mother's life. And she was expecting her fourth child, and everything was happening as planned, except in the delivery room, a heartbeat wasn't detected, and Joanne's fourth daughter, Cheyenne, was actually a stillbirth.
And everything had gone very normally, right up until practically the very last minute, so that she had no clue that there was going to be any problem. She was really expecting to give birth to a live and healthy baby.
Yes, and no preparation. Now, in Joanne's own words, through the story, we actually follow her trying to overcome her sense of grief and numbness. And I want to say here that I'm in no way saying that the stages of grief we enter are not the most painful things that we can experience in this lifetime when we lose someone. So I don't want people to get the idea that we're kind of saying, oh, it's all fine and don't worry about it. Those human emotional, incredibly deep pain and suffering we go through is a part of this process. But again, through Joanne's story, we see how no one was really willing to support her. They didn't want to be with her in grief. They wanted her to be the normal person that they knew, because, again, as you stated earlier, this denial of death and dying and people who are bereaved is very prevalent in our culture. We no longer wear armbands, as people did in Victorian times, to signify that grieving was taking place, that a death had occurred, that somebody had lost something very important to them. But getting back to Joanne was motivated when she saw the lack of support for mothers like herself who had gone through what she had gone through. She was motivated to put together a program that would help other people in the same situation. And from that little kernel grew the Miss Foundation, her interactions with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who I'm sure many people will be familiar with, and this wonderful work that she is now doing. And I think one of the most interesting parts of Joanne's story is that we see that this pain and suffering, she describes in her own words, woke her from a form of spiritual dormancy, that suddenly everything became a lot clearer to her, that she had something to do, a mission for this lifetime, and that more than that, perhaps Joanne's, you know, baby's life actually did have some incredible meaning. When we look at it, rather than just in that particular moment of when Joanne had a stillborn daughter, that something else again was happening, that Cheyenne actually altered and was part of thousands of people's lives and still is to this very day. So it's a very interesting story from that point of view, and how Joanne realized, you know, how important it was to express caring and compassion, which she talks about in her kindness project, that rather than forget about a death, a parent will actually buy one of what she calls her kindness project cards, where they will do something very charitable for someone else in memory of their dying or dead child, rather than pretend it never happened. And this promotes healing. And as she's sold over 700,000 of these kindness project cards, I think, you know, she's on the right track.
So that out of her grief, there was some transformation that happened in her life and became manifest in the world in terms of forming an organization that's been important to other mothers who went through a stillbirth, and also this kindness project that you're referring to. Now, how did you come to write this book?
Well, my own mother was going through the dying process, and it was a very painful and long journey for her, and I had this sense again of what else was going on. And rather than, you know, just be in that place of losing my mother, which was very, very traumatizing, it is always is when we're losing someone close to us, especially a parent, because we seem to lose our connection to where we came from, you know, when the parent is no longer there with us. But I decided that I wanted to really be fully present with her on that journey that she made. And through that, I discovered that there were many other things that we can be party to, you know, moments of real clarity, beauty, love. I think that death strips away everything that is unimportant and gives us the chance to be our most authentic selves. You know, if we fully engage, there's no place to run away and hide, and I think that brings out the potential in each person to actually see what the cycle of life is really about. And in some ways I would describe it as the miracle of death. The miracle of life and the miracle of death are interwoven. So through my own experiences, I started to collect stories from other people that had had some kind of dramatic shift through engaging with death and dying, or maybe just not in being physically with somebody who was, you know, in the dying process, but also people that had had a sense of what death actually means, which was people with near-death experiences, people who had had some form of after-death communication or some kind of healing through the power of prayer, something that hinted at this other central, subtle movement that was going on that we can, you know, miss very easily if we go into denial, which is normally a person's response. And as I started working on the book, I found it more and more absorbing for me, and it became a very powerful project. So all the people that were involved also had such remarkable stories that I felt that it was such an important way of perhaps looking at death and dying and the whole matter of consciousness in a slightly different way.
Yes, yes. Now, I wonder about your own spiritual orientation and what you could say about that. I went to a website promoting your book, and there seemed to be a lot there about the Course in Miracles, and I'm wondering if the Course in Miracles played an important role in your journey.
I think for myself, I started off as a Roman Catholic for many years. I went to a convent all my school life. My mother was Italian. I was very imbued with Catholicism. And as I became older and started to embrace my own ideas and beliefs, I have come to a place where everything has a kernel for me. A Course in Miracles has been important in my life. Buddhist philosophy, Indian religions, Native American religions, and African religions, they all actually, for me anyway, seem to point to the same thing, have the same message. They're all culturally different in some respects, but I guess I'm more ecumenical now. I like to embrace all religions, and rather than, you know, hone in on anything particular, I like to look at the message that is in all of these sacred texts that belong to various religions, and I think actually is a place that resides in us, that we have an inner knowing of these texts and sacred information that we have lost connection with now.
Okay, I can certainly relate to that. Now, a number of the stories involve the tunnel of white light experience. And it seems to me that in each of those cases that I read, the person either was currently religious or had been in the past. Do you know of any instances in which someone who is and has always has been a complete atheist has had a white light experience and has been turned around by it?
Well, yes. One of the things about the near-death experience is that it's not necessary to have any religious conviction to have such an experience. You know, one of the perhaps better-known stories is that of the Reverend Howard Storm, who was a complete agnostic, atheist, or had no belief. But he had a near-death experience, and as you can tell now, he's a reverend. His whole understanding and belief system changed. So I think this can happen to anybody. But the usual outcome is, I'm not saying that they're going to become a religious person, but perhaps spiritual values seem to be of paramount importance. Compassion, kindness, connectedness with all life forms. And when we see the incredible cruelty that goes on in the world in so many places, I mean, just now I'm looking, you know, at the news this morning and I see this little piece about some animals that were slaughtered, and when we feel what actually the world we live in, we see these people who seem to come back with a whole different way of viewing life. And whether one believes that they went to an afterlife or whether they didn't is up to individual belief systems. But one thing that I'm firmly convinced of is that these people are changed permanently. It's not like something, you know, that happens and then after a few weeks they go back to their normal lives and it's like it never happened. This is a permanent change, and these people tend to go out and live very different lives, often in service to other people. So all I can say is something very extraordinary happens, and that happens to a person whether they're religious or not religious, or spiritual or not spiritual.
Yes, I had a friend who did a doctoral research around out-of-the-body experiences, and he found something similar that I think you would attest to as well. which is that these people lose all fear of dying after that.
Yes, certainly. I mean, that's one of the reasons that these stories are so powerful, because these people do lose all fear of death and have an unshakable belief in a continuum of consciousness. But perhaps more importantly is that they don't fear death. And I think it's a subconscious anxiety within all of us that makes people, you know, power-driven, the way we live our lives in this very materially driven society, or, you know, one lot of people warring with another lot of people. I think it all goes back to this place where we're so centered on this life we're living, and we really believe that that's the ultimate reality. And that one of the main messages from the near-death experience is, you know, live your life a little differently, view the world a little differently. Again, I think one of the ultimate realities that you don't have to have a near-death experience to understand is that when the moon comes out or the sun sets and we look up into the sky and we see this round globe or sphere out in space, an infinite space, that is the Earth, you know? Just that one sort of observation can change our whole outlook, I believe, because it changes our reality.
Okay. Now, I'm sure you know that the skeptical position on white light and other sorts of near-death euphoria has to do with certain chemicals that are released in the brain at the time of death. What are your thoughts about this?
I think that, again, you know, scientific and medical knowledge is very helpful. And certainly there's a lot of interest in trying to discover what is going on. But there have been studies. There were studies taken in a Dutch hospital where a number of patients who had had drugs or who hadn't had drugs or sudden trauma or not were all monitored. And we have this sort of, on the one hand, we have this very skeptical outlook that, you know, this is something that happens because the dying brain is trying to protect us from death, or this change of chemicals occurs, hallucinations or whatever. But I think that the problem with this is, again, we're grounding it in very sort of like human day terms. The truth of the matter is we don't actually know what happens in that moment. We have stories from people who tell us of their experiences, and we're trying to prove all the while, could this be true? Could this be, you know, just this? Could it be hallucinations? Could it be drugs? But the truth of the matter is we don't know, and we don't know anything about the mysteries of death ourselves until we ultimately experience that. All we can take from these experiences is the possibility that something else is happening, and maybe even look at it from the point of view that we don't have to try and explain it rationally, mm-hmm. because perhaps all that may take place, but something else may be taking place at the same time. I mean, that's the only thing that I really feel very strongly, that these people come back and they are certain of what has happened to them. The white light, the not wanting to come back to the body. Another thing is that often these people come back with very enhanced gifts, healing powers, telepathic gifts, you know. So why would that happen? You know, again, some people might say, well, some rearrangement of chemicals in the brain has taken place, but we don't know.
Okay, well, that's a very good response. Now, how did you find the people whose accounts are in the book?
To a large extent, they just happened. Once I decided to write this book, you know, I believe very strongly in synchronicity,
yes.
That once something is on a roll, it takes a life of its own, and certainly that was what happened. A friend would say to me, oh, I know this man, Peter Samuelson, for example. He would have a wonderful story, and I would get in touch with him, which I did. Peter's story is in the book, which again is a wonderful story of how engaging with a young boy dying from inoperable cancer actually led him to start the Starlight Children's Foundation, which does so much for seriously ill children that it's now a huge, huge organization all over the world. So these were the kind of contacts I was getting. Reuben Beckham, the first person whose story is in the book, who is a personal friend of mine, I met when my mother was dying. And for me, meeting Reuben, who had had a near-death experience, was a very comforting thing for me to experience when I was going through my mother's dying process. And his story, again, was very powerful because he's such an unassuming man who has had an incredible life and still does, with an energy that now works in death and dying, you know, as a spiritual counselor, which one would be finding it hard to follow a man who of nearly 70 who's working 16 hours a day round the clock sometimes, but with, you know, having had failing health, but he does. So I found these stories as I sort of they just came to me, or I got introduced to them, and I would speak to the people, and they sort of just all came together.
It's wonderful the way that happens, that once you have that intention and set out on your project, that the universe just seems to open up and provide you with exactly the material that you need.
Yes, and I think once again, you know, what you just said again is something that I'm trying to put forward in the book, is that that is what happens. Once we just open a chink in ourselves, or we allow something to come in whereby we can then put it out into the universe, something does seem to align. And again, this is one of these things which you can't explain, now, but it happens.
You mentioned your 70-year-old friend who's done a lot of work with dying people, and I know you've done a lot of hospice work. What has being with the dying taught you?
Well, I think I noticed most of all, I'm not saying this in all circumstances, because obviously there are times when people would say, well, none of this happened, it wasn't a very pleasant thing, you know, when so-and-so died or whatever. But I think, again, if we fully engage and we're really with the person ourselves, stripped down, we allow this energy that we were just talking about that is similar to what would happen in a synchronicity to happen. And I was working in an AIDS hospice a few years ago at the time when there were no cocktails available, and unfortunately a large number of young men, especially as we all know, you know, died very premature and often quite painful deaths. And I remember on one occasion there was somebody that I had known for a few months, and he had started off when I first knew him walking with crutches, and then gradually in a wheelchair, and then having surgery and deteriorating. And one day, it was the most beautiful October day, and I saw him. He was very, very frail at that time, and he had an oxygen with him. But he turned around and he said to me, "Isn't this the most beautiful day?" And I looked at him and I thought, he's so close to this place of leaving this world. And even through the physical pain and deterioration he's going through, he just connected with that place. And the only thing he wanted to do was to be taken down to the sea, to be wheeled down to the sea. And I thought of how incredibly amazing it was that he was transcending that place, you know, connecting with something else. And he always stuck in my mind. I've never forgotten that moment or him because of that. And I believe that we have those moments, those very precious moments that sometimes the most simple thing can be so profound for us. So that, for me, was very memorable.
You quote Gandhi as saying, the best way to find yourself is to lose yourself in the service of others.
Yes. I think one of the things from the stories that people will see is that after people have gone through these very incredible experiences, something that they tend to do with their lives is to be in service in some way to humanity. And I think that the quote of Gandhi is so powerful because it's so true. You know, we can sit on a chair at home bemoaning this, that, and the other, and what's happening to us or what isn't happening to us or what we want and what we're not getting. And we can just stay stuck in that place. But, you know, like Peter Samuelson in Peter's story says, you know, go out there and volunteer. Take that piece of you. Go out that out and volunteer for some worthy cause. And everything for you will change in an instant. And I believe that to be true.
Well, Anna Maria Hemingway, that's a wonderful place for us to close. So I want to thank you so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you very much for having me. And, you know, I do hope to encourage people to perhaps overcome their resistance and take a look at these stories and perhaps find that they're very helpful to them.
I hope you found some inspiration in this interview with Anna Maria Hemingway. I know I did as I read her book, which I'm happy to recommend to you. As a matter of fact, there was a passage I thought I might ask her to read, but opted not to because I didn't want the interview to run too long. Let me read it to you now. For many who are seeking a sense of meaning in their lives, interacting with someone in the dying process serves as a catalyst to dive into the very essence of the inner being and to experience a profound spiritual transformation. For those close to death are in an altered state of consciousness, and choosing to accompany them on part of their journey enables the heart to open up to compassion. Through focusing in the present moment and peeling off the layers of fear and tension that are a form of spiritual dormancy, it's possible to realize our highest potential as human beings. The dying process and its aftermath can also facilitate a time of reconciliation in which bitter rifts and estrangements are healed. This can enable individuals to move forward in a state of wisdom and grace and to reconnect with an expanded awareness that illuminates a sense of destiny and purpose. For death engages a psychic, numinous energy that shifts preconceived perceptions of the essential meaning of life. Every interaction with death and dying involves entering the underworld of painful grief and suffering, but each also provides the opportunity to emerge from the experience with a sense of awe and greater insight into the mystery of creation. Death teaches us that the preciousness of life must be lived with a sense of purpose and meaning and as a celebration of our existence. Often these philosophical reflections instill the urge and inspiration to help and serve others as we discover the larger concept in which it is possible to put into practice these newfound truths that have value beyond death. For the dying process is a ritual and serves as an initiation into the understanding of what it really means to live. Some of the ideas that really struck me in that passage were, first of all, the insight that the dying person enters an altered state of consciousness, potentially a rather special one, and that the person who is willing to sit vigil with that person may be pulled into that altered state with them, transforming their own experience in the process. She also says that choosing to accompany a person on this journey opens the heart up to compassion, and this reminds me that compassion is a central spiritual concept in Buddhism. I believe it's one that the Dalai Lama and others have written and spoken about extensively, and I'm struck by the line that acknowledges that the dying process and its aftermath can facilitate a time of reconciliation in which all rifts and estrangements are healed. My own mother died some years ago, and I recall being impressed at the funeral by people who showed up who had been at odds with her in earlier years. At such a time, we realize how petty our differences are, and ideally they fall away. And finally, I also resonated with the idea of the dying process as a ritual and initiation, both for the dying person and for the person who sits vigil with them.
Let us all come together to see what we can find. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind. Let us all remember what you seek is what you find. And Dr. Dave is here to remind you it's all in your mind. Exploring the spirit and our psyche, we are learning to unwind. And Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind.
I thought this seemed like a particularly appropriate time to play the long version of that song. I hope you agree. Now, as I create this, Shrink Wrap Radio is still featured in the middle of the podcast page on iTunes, and we've also risen to the number 4 position there on the higher education podcasts. This means we have hundreds of new listeners, I think. It also confirms your good taste in choosing to subscribe to Shrink Wrap Radio. You are not alone. Others agree with you. And of course, all this makes me quite happy. So for those of you who might be new to Shrink Wrap Radio, let me give you a quick overview of how things have evolved. At this point, we are in our second year of the podcast. It's been about a year and a half. The podcast comes out about once a week and is usually released on Friday or Saturday. At this point, most shows last for about an hour, plus or minus a bit. The format that has evolved is that there's a standard opening intro to the show, then you hear a brief sample of the person I'm interviewing, then I give a bit of background about that person, then we go to the interview, then I generally will give some post-interview commentary. Then there'll be a musical bridge leading into the news and announcements portion, which is where I am at this moment. Then there is usually another brief bridge based on some audio comment a listener has sent in, which signals moving on to a reading of some listener emails, and finally, information about how to contact the show and who the next week's guest will be. Of course, I'm hoping you will subscribe, stay subscribed, and listen to the whole show. But what if you don't have an hour to spare? Well, the interviews themselves are usually about 30 to 40 minutes in length. So even though I think you'll be missing good stuff in the other bits. You certainly could just skip over everything else and listen only to the interview. Also, as a newcomer, you should know that this is show number 139 and that the previous 138 shows are still timely and all of them are available on the website, but not all are available in the feed. So if you're subscribing in iTunes or some other podcatcher, they currently only go back as far as show number 64, and with each succeeding week, another show will be dropped. So if you want to hear any earlier ones than that, you have to go to our website. Now, the website, too, has gone through a lot of evolution, and you really should visit it if you haven't. You'll find that you can search by the topics you're interested in, plus you will see that the shows have been lumped into about a dozen different categories, categories such as research psychology, depth psychology, personal growth, and so on. Also, on the website, notice that there's a menu item that says All Shows. That will allow you to scroll through the titles of all the shows from number one to the present one. Believe me, there is something here for everyone, and I'm constantly expanding in new and surprising directions and also inviting guests suggested by listeners. On our website, you'll find a link to a Frapper map. It's fun to see where our listeners are located, and so you're invited to go to the site and add yourself to the map. I generally welcome on the air the people who do so. Currently, we have no new additions, but you could change that. As I've mentioned before, I'm going to be in Barcelona in early May, and I would love to meet one or more of you there if you happen to be in that area. So let me know. Now, I also have a second interview podcast, which you'll find at www.wisecounselpodcast.com. I do a new interview there twice a month, and those interviews tend to be more narrowly focused on issues related to psychotherapy. Finally, we have very little in the way of commercials, but we do have two sponsors for this show, and they are Podshow at podshow.com and GoDaddy. You can save 10% on your domain name purchases at GoDaddy.com by using our discount code of SHRINK3. And there, that's the end of the commercial. That wasn't so burdensome, was it?
Hi, this is Kira Van Nuys Martin, and you're on the couch with my dad, Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Kira, and thank you for the second granddaughter you have delivered to us just this very morning. We're taking care of the first grandchild here and haven't had a chance to go see the second one at the hospital yet, but we are looking forward to meeting her. So now let's turn to some recent listener emails. The first comes from Mark, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave, this is Mark in Edmonton. I discovered your show a year or so ago when you were a guest on Are You Serious's show, and I've been enjoying it ever since. I added myself to your Frapper map recently, though the photo I posted is a few years old now. Some time ago on one of your shows, it may have been the one with Dr. Philip Zimbardo, I don't quite recall, there was a mention of using experimentation in service of evolutionary psychology, designing experiments through which we might learn not only about how the mind works, but how it came to work that way. I was quite taken with the idea, and I wonder if you might recommend some books or other resources I could look into, and of course, any future episodes of your show that dealt with that topic would be welcome. In closing, I'll just say thank you for all the great shows. I'm looking forward to springtime so I can listen to you while working in the garden. Kind regards, Mark." Well, kind regards right back to you, Mark. I'm really glad to hear that the Are You Serious show got me a listener or two. I really loved listening to his podcasts, and I haven't been able to find them recently. I've dropped him a line just now to see what's going on. I'm hoping he's okay. And, you know, try as I might, I can't remember what I might have said about evolutionary psychology, and there are no books that come to mind readily, although I know it's an important area. If you do a search on Amazon.com using the term evolutionary psychology, you'll definitely get a number of books that come up, and I will think about that as a topic for the future. Next, we hear from Erno in the Netherlands, who writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, thanks for the very interesting interview with my fellow countryman, Jaap Hollander on Mind Mentor. Yap is great. I've read his books and have done some workshops on provocative coaching, of which he's a real promoter. In April, I will visit a seminar with Yap. In fact, I use provocative coaching quite regularly in both my personal relationships and as in coaching colleagues and students. The good thing about provocation is that it causes movement in what's stuck. Movement away from the problem instead of digging in. In that regard, it's just the same as what Dr. Edward de Bono means with by provocation as a tool in creative thinking. He goes on to say that he wrote a blog entry on the show, but it's in Dutch. He gives me the link, but I don't think it's going to do me any good. Keep up your very good work. Best regards, Erno. Erno, thanks so much. The next one comes from Italy. Hello, Dr. Dave. I'm an Italian listener of yours. I live in the northeastern tip of Italy in Udine. I hope I said that right. I gave it my best try. I heard about your podcast from your appearance on the Are You Serious show, if I remember correctly. Wow, nobody has ever mentioned the Are You Serious episodes or appearances before, and then I get two listener emails right around the same time referring to it. Ever since then, I've listened to many of your shows. I like your voice, your slow and clear pronunciation. I would recommend your podcast to anybody learning American English. Thank you very much. That's a very nice compliment. He goes on to say, I admire the calm attention that you give all your guests. I don't particularly share your mystical side, as I have a hard science view of the world, but I enjoy listening to you talk about it anyway. Still, perhaps you could make some shows on topics such as psychology, body language, the dynamics of couples, and so on. I am considering myself getting some psychological counseling. My problem is that I'm still a single man at 48 with a solitary and shy character. Perhaps a therapist can convince me that having relationships with women is not mission impossible for me. Keep up the great work. And then he signs his name, which begins with G. And I won't say any more than that since I didn't have his permission. And there is this personal bit at the end about possibly seeking counseling, being single at 48. I urge you to go ahead. I do think that counseling could be of substantial help in overcoming your shyness and learning to approach women. And I know there are lots of women out there who would treasure a sincere and mature man. So, and one with scientific orientation. And I'm only mystical some of the time. I have both sides are very strong in me, both the strong commitment to science and interest in it, but also some mystical leanings I must confess to. And finally, one more from Mark in Chicago, who writes, Dr. Dave, I just wanted to let you know that I'm a new listener. I found you when you were promoted on the main page at iTunes. Yes, that does help. And I love the podcasts. They've become my number one diversion over the past couple of weeks. And they make these cold Chicago bus and train commutes much more bearable. Your new listeners are especially fortunate because we suddenly have a massive library to choose from. I would especially love for you to explore more on mindfulness and spirituality. It's not only out there, Bay Area types that enjoy those interviews. In truth, I'm a former Bay Area resident, but I'm originally from the Midwest, he says. I thoroughly enjoyed the Undoing the Ego, Buddhist Thinking, the Secret Spiritual World of Children podcasts. I think the topic of mindfulness and overcoming the ego are going to be on the public's mind, especially as Oprah has recently endorsed the teachings of Eckhart Tolle. Or is it Tolle? I don't know. I know lots of people who are very enthusiastic about his book. He goes on to say in parentheses, she picked A New Earth as her book of the month and is teaching an internet seminar with him. Thank you sincerely for your podcast. And that comes from Mike, who mentions that he's 30 and he's in Chicago. Thanks for that, Mike. Be sure to check out my Wise Counsel podcast, too, as if you didn't have a massive enough shrink wrap radio collection. But there have been several podcasts in the Wise Counsel series dealing with approaches that utilize mindfulness as part of some very well-researched therapeutic approaches, you'll find those shows at www.wisecounselpodcast.com. So that better wrap it up for the email for today. Remember, you can send your emails, and I love them, to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area right on the site. There's an area where you can post your comments. And you can leave voicemails on Skype where the name is ShrinkPod. You can leave voice messages using the My Chingo button on our website. Or you can call us and leave a voice message at 206-337-0622. Thanks again to my guest, Anna Maria Hemingway, for sharing her wisdom on conscious living and dying. My next guest will be Jungian analyst John Beebe, MD, and we'll be discussing Jung's theory of types. I hope you'll join us for that show. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.